when I think about, do I want to continue raising awareness to mental health, or what makes me continue doing it, I think of mum, and I think, you know, no mum should ever lose a child to suicide. And if I can help others open up their eyes to have conversations and not go through that, then I've done my job. So for me, whilst it is sad to think about mum and the life she leads now and being broken, and her pain certainly resonates with me every day to keep doing what I do, that's for sure.
Life gives you two choices when it throws everything at you. You can let it swallow you whole, or you take those lemons. And as the old saying goes, you turn it into sweet, delicious lemonade. And that's exactly what this podcast is all about. Welcome to Lemonade. I'm your host, Elizabeth O'Neill, and I'll be sharing the incredible stories from inspiring people who've turned the hardest times in their life, their lemons, into lemonade. Because let's be real, we all want to know how they did it, the lessons they learnt, and what life is like sipping limoncello on the other side. Let's get juicing. Mitch McPherson's entire world was upended when, at the beginning of 2013, his 18-year-old brother, Ty, took his own life. Immersed in grief, he decided the least he could do was try and keep Ty's name alive. So he traced a simple drawing of a pair of shorts, as his little brother was always dressed in footy shorts, along with the words, "Speak up, stay chatty," with the TY at the end of chatty capitalized. Mitch had no idea this simple sketch would be the catalyst for the creation of one of the most acclaimed suicide prevention and mental health promotion programs in the country. This is an incredible story of vulnerability, strength, and the undying love of one man for his little brother. A young life gone far too soon, just like the more than 3,000 Australians who take their life every year. 75% of those male. Heartbreakingly, suicide is the leading cause of death for people aged between 15 and 44. That's why movements like Stay Chatty are so vitally important. Mitch's work has saved lives. In this chat, Mitch and I discuss his new role as a father to his beautiful little daughter, the impact losing his brother has had on how he'll raise her, how we should be raising young men in today's world by teaching them to be vulnerable, to speak up when they feel down, and to be in touch with their feelings. Speak Up, Stay Chatty's humble beginnings, and how it's grown to what it is today. A trigger warning, this conversation addresses suicide. If you or anyone you know needs help, 24-hour crisis support is available through Lifeline on 13 11 14. Here's Mitch. Mitch, thank you so much for joining me on the Lemonade podcast. I'm so thrilled we've finally made it happen.
Pleasure to be here. Yeah, a couple of false starts with life getting in the way for both of us in the past. But yeah, I'm thrilled to be here. So thank you.
With all my guests, I always love to ask them how isolation is treating them. Well, you know, all my guests lately, because that seems to be all anyone can speak about right now. But yours has been particularly special because you became a father. That's way more interesting than baking banana bread. Yes, how is your gorgeous little girl, Maya?
Yeah, wonderful. It's been really odd. Like, it's just so strange. Like, in the last week or two, we've kind of relaxed it a little bit in terms of people coming around and meeting her, not necessarily holding her and having cuddles, etc. But it's been very strange. Like, that, you know, we've never had a child before, but just to live that life of the excitement but not being able to really share that with anyone. But, yeah, on a whole, she's amazing. I'm a smitten dad. Everyone said, you know, when I said I was having a daughter, they're like, oh, sons are awesome, but, you know, having a daughter, she'll be a daddy's girl and it'll be the best thing ever. And it totally is. Like, I just want to wake her up and cuddle her all the time. And
your wife's like, no, don't wake her up.
And I think I grow the worst beard on earth, but I think my little facial hair tickles her and gives her a little rash on her side of her face, but that's okay. And yeah, it's been amazing. And touch wood, she's healthy and fit. And it's been a good time.
I can only imagine how difficult it must be. It would have been, you said to me off before we started that she's 8 weeks old, almost 8 weeks old, to not have had anyone coming over. And that's the best time, is when you've got that new baby. You just want to show them off to the entire world because you're so proud, but you didn't really get to do that.
No. And I mean, immediate family have come from the moment we got home. I think the hardest bit was probably the hospital. We had 5 nights in at the hospital. And, you know, for even when I left to go get my coffee or food, you know, no one could sort of tap in and come in as well. And my wife comes from a really big family, and they're very, very family orientated and extremely close with her mum, and like a lot of people are. But yeah, that initial 5 days in hospital was like, yeah, cabin fever times 100. Just wanted to get out of there and show her off. So at least we're home and now people can call in, and albeit look at her from a distance, we're still able to share that excitement, which has been fun.
And what do you think has surprised you most about fatherhood so far?
What surprised me most? Probably I'd held babies in the past and had been a total nervous wreck, like friends and family. I've got a niece and nephew who are 10 and 9. But I've been surprised at how comfortable I've been to just sort of launch in and pick her up. And I think people have said that as well, that when it's your own, I think more the pressure for me in the past was holding babies and worrying what the parent was going to judge me. Like, oh, my God, he's not supporting the neck or whatever. But here, definitely not rough, you know, but I feel so comfortable to launch in and pick her up at any stage. And, that sort of surprised me, because I thought I'd be a real nervous wrecking being really carefully picking her up. But that's been a breeze. So that's probably a really positive surprise, I think.
Yeah, definitely. That makes so much sense as well. Now, you are so influential in the field of mental health, and that's obviously a huge struggle for so many people, so many of us right now, with everything that's going on with the coronavirus and being isolated and people losing their jobs and ways of life. What can we be doing to support ourselves through this time right now, in your opinion?
Yeah, well, it's become a really common word, connection, over the last while. Like when this first happened, I was sort of, for me, it was a weird transition, because I hurt my knee, which we'll probably talk about later. We had a baby, and then at work, coronavirus kicked in and everyone was starting to work from home. And so I've still been involved as much as I can. It's been strange not working through this. All the guys are working from home. And connection has been a word, a buzzword, if you like, that you sort of turn on the news or you listen to podcasts and here we are talking about the word connection. But the reality is, this is so true that, you know, and it sounds a bit cliche to pick up the phone when you're feeling flat and make sure you have those conversations, but you just have to do it. And I'm, you know, sure we'll talk about my journey and what I've been through in the last 8 weeks. You have those moments, but it's just all about fighting through and knowing that that's the right thing to do. We all wake up and have, you know, you have shitty days, you have shitty nights, and you wake up and you just don't feel like you've got the energy to pick up the phone or get on, you know, FaceTime with someone. But what I've done, and I've practiced what I preach, is just do it even though I don't feel like it, because when I hang up, I feel better. And I think there's, I don't know the science around it, but I guarantee that 9 out of 10 people will feel better after making that connection. So just so important, because the novelty wears off. You know, everyone's working from home, or, you know, people are schooling from home, and all the parents and people I know that are working from home and doing that, by now the novelty's worn off and we're all like, let's get back to normality. And absolutely. So that's why having your FaceTimes and your chats and your connection with your mates is so important. So it is a buzzword that we all go on about and we're hearing a lot about, but think about it and find ways in which you can do it, because it absolutely will help you.
Absolutely. Now, this is how I usually start my podcast pre-corona, but I always start by asking the guests what their childhood was like and getting an idea of what kinds of things they were interested in, what their family dynamic was like. So, Mitch, what was it like for you? What was growing up like for you?
Growing up was fun. I'm the eldest of three. I mean, we grew up, I think in my book I wrote, we didn't have a whole heap of money. Dad was a butcher. He ended up getting a job at the prison, was working as a custodial officer. Mum didn't work. She did a bit of cleaning. But I remember us, Mum and Dad, being quite social, which was good. You know, they had a lot of friends. And so I have fond memories of, you know, barbecues and visiting people's houses. And, you know, those nights where you're a young kid falling asleep on the couch and Mum or Dad are picking you up at 2, 3 a.m. to load you in the car when you're half asleep and it's the worst thing in the world. Falling into bed is the best thing after that.
Yeah.
So I remember a lot of that. When people have asked me, you know, was I close with my family growing up? I was. It's strange in my whole journey, which we'll talk about, I kind of find that I focus on friends a lot really early, and I think that I put friends as and making friends and keeping friends happy more of a priority throughout my probably, you know, late primary school into high school years. And it's something I sort of regret a little bit. Like, you know, don't get me wrong, I was extremely close with my family, but, you know, if I woke up of a morning, I would probably automatically think, what are my friends doing today, rather than let's go and spend some time with Mum, Dad, or my brother or my sister.
Yeah.
And if I probably had my time again, I wish I'd been taught, or I just wish I was the type of person that put family first more. And I think that's probably why these days I turn to my wife first to see what we're going to do during the day before I will hang out with a mate. I just think it's really important, and especially now we've got a child, I think I want her to grow up and really prioritise us as she gets older, and want her to spend as much time with us as possible. But yeah, I had a fun time. I played every possible sport under the sun, you know, footy, cricket, softball. Yeah, I was fortunate enough to have friends. I wouldn't say I was the coolest guy. I think I probably spent a bit of my high school years, I went to an all-boys school called St. Virgil's down here in Hobart, and I sort of was in the middle. I was kind of like trying to hang out with the cool guys, but I wasn't cool enough to, like, you know, they'd sort of hang out with me some days and then some days they wouldn't.
High school's so brutal.
Yeah, it is brutal. And again, I think back now, you know, that's why when I work in schools now and obviously talk about mental health and talk about, I just wish I was myself, you know. One thing I preach now is where every single person in this world is doing life the best they can so that they put their head on the pillow at night to get a good night's sleep. And I kind of wish I knew that back then, you know. That's why I try and educate kids that now, you know, because it just doesn't matter. You know, you just got to be yourself and be true to that, and the people that want to be around you will, and the people that won't, and that's fine. You know, there's millions and millions and billions of people on this earth. So, yeah, I spent a bit of time chasing, trying to find out who I was, and the reality is I don't really think I worked out who I was until after college when I had a job and was working and, you know, started to put back into family and, you know, still really big on my friends, and I still am today. But, yeah, it was interesting. I sometimes sit and reminisce about my life, what it was like when I was young. And there's certainly, like a lot of us, a lot of things I'd do differently, but it's certainly a lot of things that I learned as well, which I think now I think about that more because of Maya now. You know, you've got to start thinking, what type of person do you want her to be, or what kind of person do you want her to perceive you to be? And so I certainly think about that now and hope to pass on as many life lessons as I possibly can.
You were saying, you know, you'd left school and everything was kind of carry on as normal, as we assume that our life is going to carry on. And it was 2013 when everything in your life and in your family's life completely upended. And I'm sure it almost started just as a normal year when 2013 began as well. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah. So when I left school in 05, a bit about that journey from 05 to 2013, I kind of left high school feeling pretty lost. I remember having a chat with Mum one day and she said, you know, I read your report and it wasn't amazing. We spent a bit of money for you to go to this school. You know, what's your life look like now? And I said, I'm not really sure, because I focused on sport. I was always the first down on the oval at high school to kick a footy around or play cricket. And I didn't really, it wasn't drilled into me. I don't know whether it was my parents or my teachers were drilling it into me, but I just didn't let it soak in that it was important to think about life after school. So then I went on to college in 04 and 05 and still didn't do it, you know. I got caught up with my mates who played at the footy club I played with for a long time. We turned 18, so the party scene kicked in. And again, I just sort of was a bit lost thinking, what is it that I'm going to do with my life? I did a couple of jobs, worked in a sports shop, did a traineeship in signwriting, and then I landed an apprenticeship in glazing. And I did that for about 7 years. Did I like glazing? Not really. I think I look back now and I sort of hope that I don't ever have to do it again. I've got my trade in it, and there were things that I learned and the people I did it with I loved and liked, but I certainly hope I don't have to get back into the trade again. But that was my life. It was, you know, putting windows in, playing sport, and just... That
cruising
was it,
living
for the weekend. So 2012 Christmas, had a fun old time with family and friends, a lot of beers, time in the sun as you do, entered 2013, and then I remember the countdown was on to the date of having to go back to work, which was the 14th of Jan. And, you know, I'd always dreaded after holidays. We know what it's like when we work and we have time off. It's a pretty ordinary feeling having to go back to work. But for me, I'd isolate myself in my room. You know, I'd do all the things that I preach people these days to not do when you're feeling flat. You know, I hid away in my bedroom. I didn't have conversations with family and friends in that last week, just thinking, you know, holy shit, I can't believe I have to go back to work next week. But, yeah, then on the 14th of Jan came around, and I went to work that day, had a normal day, got home. I was actually arguing with my girlfriend. She's now my wife now, Sahar. She'd come down to Dad's for the night to have some dinner with me. And I never forget, you know, I'd promised her the night before that if she came down, I'd cook her some veggies for dinner. But classic Mitch McPherson back then, she'd come down and I was telling her I'd had a massive day at work and I was encouraging her to drive me to get McDonald's. So she started giving me a bit of a spray in the bedroom, calling me a liar for promising her veggies and not doing it. But then out of the blue, we got a scream upstairs from my dad and my stepmom. Pandemonium kicked in, ran upstairs, saw my dad, and he was telling us that mum had called him to let us know that my little brother Ty, who'd just turned 18, had suicided and had taken his own life. And, you know, you talk about things you learn and life and everything just sort of flashes before you, you know, and suicide, there'll be a lot of people that listen that have been through it. And for me, straight away, was just that guilt. I know that I've learned now that it's not my fault that Ty took his life, but the first emotion I felt was guilt. You know, he was my best friend. I was 25, he was 18. We, you know, wrestled, backyard cricket, footy, pick him up, drop him off, transferring money, all those things that you get to do when you have a sibling around your same age. So I just felt that guilt straight away, and I still feel it, you know, these days sometimes. You sort of learn to live with it. But, yeah, in those initial stages, I would have given anything to just go back in time and, you know, find out why he was feeling that way or wish that I could have done something different. So, yeah, ultimately losing him entered us into a roller coaster of misery and hell for a very, very long time, that's for sure.
When you look back at that time, were there any changes in his behaviour before that day that you noticed or didn't notice and you might have missed?
Yeah, for sure. So a big part of my story, and now, as you say, we'll get into it about me being a mental health advocate and speaker. It took us a while, you know, that grief, that sadness, that guilt, you know, burying him, moving forward without him, trying to work out, you know, what went wrong. I remember having lots of conversations with people, and in particular one, the funeral director, who was actually a family friend, 3 days after we lost Ty, he said, "Did you see signs in Ty that he was struggling?" And automatically we'd all say no, you know, he was fun, he was 18, he was popular, he was a happy-go-lucky guy. That day when the funeral director asked me, I nearly threw a vase of flowers at him because I thought, you know, how dare you assume that he was struggling or going through a dark time? I'm not a violent person, but it just sort of came over me thinking a frustration, how dare you assume that? But as the weeks and months passed, I remember one night sitting at home and just thinking about those moments in the past, thinking about, you know, when I saw Ty, moments I spent with him, times I saw him. And it, all of a sudden, just out of nowhere, it really did start to click and register with me that, hey, it was only a couple of weeks, but there were moments where he wasn't okay and Ty was not himself. And I remember sharing those with my dad and my mum and my stepmum and my sister. And when I started to share them, I remember it was like a beam went off in their eyes where they also were starting to reflect back on moments. And we realised we were wrong in saying that he was okay, because the truth was that he was actually struggling and going through a bit of a dark period. You know, he stopped eating dinner. Like Tig, I joke about, he was like Usain Bolt at dinner time. When someone would shout out, "Dinner's ready," he'd fly out to the kitchen and knock over humans and furniture just to get his ass to the kitchen table. He'd love eating dinner with us. But in the last 2 weeks, there were probably 4 or 5 nights where he didn't come out of his bedroom and join us. And, you know, we all spoke about it. You know, where's Tig? Tig's his nickname. You know, he's 18. He probably ate earlier. He's fine. Let's leave him alone. You know, upon reflection, they're the moments now that I preach to people, you know, that change, that 1%. You know, when someone's off their game, it's so important to go and check in and ask what's going on and poke and prod them a little bit to find out. 4 days before he took his life, I caught him walking home. He was probably about a half an hour walk from home. I offered him a lift. He said no. You know, I usually jump on the bonnet of the car to get a lift home with me and play some cricket. And, you know, I remember driving off that day, looking at him in the rear view. His head had dropped. He was dawdling along the road. And, even the night before he passed away, saying goodnight to him. That's how I finished my presentation, talk about wanting to go back in time. I never forget looking at him, mumbling the word night to me. And I often say, you know, he had tears in his eyes. He had pale face. And he was a young guy laying there praying that someone would ask, "Are you okay?" Or praying he had the courage to call me in and say, "No, I'm not, you know, I need to have a conversation." And, you know, so those moments for me, whilst they hurt and whilst they, you know, are difficult to think about, I think, I hope that they're a learning curve for others, you know. And I said a moment ago, 1%ers, you've got to check in, you know. If someone's 1% off, it's so important to just look at them and sit them down and say, "Mate, 1 in 5 go through this. You're not alone. You're not strange, you're not weird, you know, make sure you talk to me, have that conversation about what it is that's getting you down." Because I I live every day living and breathing this and hoping others don't go through what Ty did. But whilst I do that, there's a huge part of me wishing I could go back in time and knew what I know now, that's for sure.
Yeah, it brings me to tears hearing you say that story. How did your parents handle this time? You're a parent now and I'm a parent. I can only imagine.
Yeah, you say you're going to tear up. I haven't spoken about this for a few weeks, having some weeks off, so battled through it myself. Mum and dad are a big driving force for me. Again, I always refer back to how I structured out my presentation and how I want it to be impactful and what I can do to make people open up their eyes to see how real suicide is. I often focus on mum and dad a lot, and I often say a parent should never lose a child, but I can't help, after living through it, think that suicide, it goes to another, another 100 levels of pain and sadness. And, I talk about that guilt that I felt and feel as a brother for mum and dad. It was awful. And they've certainly changed their life now. Mum, she split with her husband. Fortunately, over the last year or two, they've got back together, which is great. They've found their way back together. But mum lost a job. She had breakdowns a lot. I lived with my dad and my stepmum, and Ty lived with mum probably 60-70% of the time, and he was the only one there, whereas my dad and my stepmum had me and my stepbrothers and sisters. So for mum, he was a little baby, and it's been incredibly hard on mum. I never forget in the weeks after, etc., getting around mum as much as I possibly could, but and seeing the pain in her voice and the breakdowns she used to have. And I still often think about them. And as hard as they are to think about, they, for me, are a really big driver in what I do. I often get upset thinking about it. And even when I'm telling people about it, I lose my way a little bit. But when I think about, do I want to continue raising awareness to mental health, or what makes me continue doing it, I think of mum. And I think, no mum should ever lose a child to suicide. And if I can help others open up their eyes to have conversations and not go through that, then I've done my job. So for me, whilst it is sad to think about mum and the life she leads now, and being broken and losing relationships and family members, etc., her pain certainly resonates with me every day to keep doing what I do, that's for sure. And dad as well. Dad's found different ways. They're separated, obviously, and they've both found different ways to deal with it. But it's fair to say that, isolation for them went up a lot. Communication with friends and that connection that we spoke about earlier is certainly a lot harder to do when you have that huge hole in your heart in losing your little boy. So, definitely it's been a long road for them.
And what kind of a person was Ty? How do you remember him?
Fun, happy, a go-lucky guy. He was very popular. He was learning to drive and one of the sad things for me, a really sad moment for Dad as well, we just spoke about. On the Monday, the day Ty took his life, he and Dad set off that Monday and they went and had a breakfast at a cafe together. They went to K&D and bought him some new tradie gear and some boots, and then they went and met his new boss and workmates and played some 8-ball and had a laugh and a morning tea, because the next day Ty was meant to start day one of a building apprenticeship with a local business in Hobart. Dad dropped him off at Mum's that afternoon. He said, "I'm going to pack a bag, come down and spend the night." It was 4 hours later that Mum rang and said that he'd, she'd found him and he'd suicided. He was happy. He appeared to be happy. I spoke about those moments earlier, that just in that last 2 weeks. We never really worked it out what it was with Ty. I think the fun, happy-go-lucky guy was something that we certainly got a little bit complacent with, and I'm sure there were a lot of nights in his life where, like that Sunday night before he died, that he probably shut his door and broke down. And I reckon that stigma was a big player for him, that he was, like a lot of people, wanted to put on that persona that everything's great and dandy and I'm good, and wanted to be perceived as that guy that could just give everyone a lift. But I'm sure behind closed doors he was just in that last couple of weeks, struggling and really didn't know how to deal with it. I think, starting a new job, thinking that I'm not quite mentally 100%, how the hell am I going to, learn to build and get on with my colleagues and be a good employee. So I think that probably put a lot of pressure on him. If only he'd just come out of his room and told us what was happening, I'm sure we would have helped him through it. But, he the youngest, he was 18. He only took his life 10 days after he passed away, and I'll never forget his 18th. We all went out and there's probably about 15 of us, his friends, some of my friends. We had a big night out. We were all a bit hungover the next day. I remember texting him and, you know, he said he was hungover. And I remember putting my head back on my bed that morning thinking, I can't believe my little brother's 18 and he's hungover, you know, like he was a baby not long ago. I often get sad that I didn't get to share more of those moments, you know, going on trips and going
bonding.
Bonding and having beers and stuff. But I'm also glad that I got one. You know, it makes me, incredibly sad about that. But I will forever hold on to that we got that one night, you know, like that one night where we could go out and have a beer and have a laugh and carry on like dickheads and be boys. It's really special that I get to have that. So, yeah, he transitioned from a boy to a man in 10 days. And, it's kind of good. We'll forever get to remember him as being that baby Tig, but also a young man that was about to step into the workforce for sure.
Where has this idea come from that men in particular, I'm sorry for making you emotional. It really hits. Where has this idea, do you think, come from that men, seemingly men in particular, don't feel like they have any other option but to resort to these drastic measures to take their own lives? Why don't they feel comfortable to reach out?
Yeah, I sat on a panel some years ago, early days when I was doing this work, and it was about values and Australians and how we see values and what are our values. And I sat on a panel with a few people, and I remember someone, I cannot remember who it was, but talking about how the male has grown up and one of the values is to be strong for his family and, you know, to be probably the breadwinner and the one that's strong and doesn't show emotion and is there for his wife and tells people to toughen up. And I honestly believe that that's brought us undone over the years. You know, that's changing now, and it's going to take a long way. You know, come a long way, but I think it's going to take a lot more to get through that. But I think that's probably where we went wrong in thinking that men have to be that type, because we forgot all those years ago that men have emotions too, and men have worries and troubles and minds. And again, I say this with absolutely zero disrespect to women, but I just think that that's how we as a society raise men to be tough and not to show their emotions. You know, how many times we heard that toughen up or get over it or you'll be right, you're a man, don't be a wuss, you know, don't be a little girl. That's played on men, I think, over the years. So, there's, thank God that society and organisations are out there reminding us that of how prevalent it is, how prevalent suicide is for men, how many men struggle, and therefore reminding us that men, it's okay to talk about your troubles and talk about your worries. And you're not strange, you're not different, you're not unusual, you're not weird, you're human, and you're going to feel it. So, I believe it goes back to that. That's where it all stems from. And so let's raise our boys these days to grow into strong men, of course, but to let them know that they can connect emotionally with themselves and reach out for support if they need it.
Yeah, I'd be really curious to know about that. That what are some of the things? As I'm the mother of a son, and there's a lot of people who listen to this that have young boys. What should we be doing to make sure our children, our sons, you know, daughters as well, of course, but our sons in particular, feel like they can express themselves, to feel like they're supported?
Yeah, I think reminding them, as I said, getting in touch with their emotions is fine. And that's got to be stemmed into people as much as we possibly can, and to reach out for support. I think if I hope I have a boy one day, but I will do it the same with Maya, to let them know that life is going to, you know, you might be 20. I was 25 and I feel I'd never experienced grief or hardship. You know, I was fit, I was healthy, I had money, I had a loving girlfriend, had mates around me, and I was feeling invincible, thinking that nothing would ever happen to me. And I think if we remind young kids growing up that life might be dandy for a lot of times, but you are going to face hardship. There is no question that in your life you will feel a pain like no other. And when you feel that, it's important that you don't deal with it on your own. That you tell your parents, the door's always open, your brothers, your sisters, your friends, you know, have connections as much as you possibly can. I think since I was a tradie, my best mate and I, Ben Fagan, who lives in, we lived in Melbourne for a long time and he lives on the Gold Coast, we ring each other every morning. And it's 5 to 8 or 8 o'clock when we're on the way to work, and it's just that little check-in. And for me, people often ask me, you know, what helps you with your self-care? And I sometimes wake up in the morning thinking, oh, I'm going to tell Benny that in the morning, and that's my little avenue to get something off my chest or make me feel better. And so I think that establishing things in your life and ways in which you can communicate with others and get things off your chest and talk, but also listen as well. Listening is therapeutic and can make you feel better and feel that you've helped people. I think that's so important. So, yeah, grow young people to get in touch with their emotions, find ways to stay connected, find the people they trust. I think trust is a big thing. And I truly believe that if we do that with young people, the next generation will grow up knowing that it's okay to talk. And, yeah, parents like you and me, when we get older, will probably rest a little bit easier knowing that our kids are adults and they know that there's support out there if they need it.
And modelling those emotions as well must be so important. Like, you know, I've teared up, you've teared up, and we've been chatting for about 20 minutes. Like, that is just a normal human reaction. And I think I'm not sure if you would agree that would be so important to show our children that we do cry and we do feel all kinds of different things, modelling it in within ourselves.
100%. My story now is it's nearly been 8 years, well, 7.5 years that the tie died. And for a lot of my journey and setting up the organisation, I would quite often write, you know, really in-depth things, and I made myself really vulnerable. And, you know, I've cried when I've spoken. I think that for people to see me making myself vulnerable is really important. And I hope that, you know, I've had tons of messages over the years and calls and people I've stopped that said, you know, I've seen you make yourself vulnerable and that's helped me. And for me, I think that's incredibly powerful. So yeah, you're right. People listening to this have, you know, yeah, if you've got to let something out, let it out, because there'll be someone out there somewhere that will help you through it and you will benefit others by doing that for sure.
It didn't take long for you to establish Speak Up, Stay Chatty in the aftermath. I think it took about, you set that up in 2014. Why was it important for you to turn what had happened into an opportunity to help other young people who may have been struggling with mental health issues?
Yeah, it was probably officially Stay Chatty was registered in early 2014. It was probably about 4 months after we lost Ty. I remember I visited Mum and it was a really sad trip. I just, like, every trip to Mum's was sad from then on. There were just, you know, tears and that guilt. I know we were all feeling it, and we were just trying to find our way out of the hole that we'd all fallen into, even months on. You know, you'd still, you know, I'd find ways to smile, and I'd gone to Melbourne to see the boys and laughed and watched the footy, but in quiet time, I was, myself and all my family were still very much in a big black hole and didn't know how to get out of it. And I remember, yeah, driving home from Mum's one day, and I, after seeing her, I thought I would like to do something positive. You know, there's got to be a way that I can turn this positive into this negative into a positive. I went home, I got a pad and pen, and I started sketching ideas for a car sticker, because I thought if I created a car sticker, maybe our friends and family can put it on their car, it can pay tribute to Ty, and we can, you know, lift our spirits, but also maybe open up other people's eyes to suicide. You know, I didn't really know anyone in the past that had suicided, and if I'd heard of it, I certainly didn't take it seriously and ever think that it could happen to me. So, yeah, Speak Up, Stay Chatty was born. Our logo is a little pair of shorts with Speak Up, Stay Chatty. The TY is capitalised, obviously, because of his name, Ty. The reason behind the footy shorts, Ty loved wearing footy shorts everywhere. You know, he'd go out for dinner, he'd go out for breakfast. He'd always just wear footy shorts. He loved them, but he'd always wear them without any undies on. Very inappropriate. There were moments over the years where we'd be watching TV and Ty would have his feet up on the coffee table. We'd have to tell him, Tig, come on, mate, put your feet down. You can only imagine what was exposed out of the side of his shorts. he was an idiot. He was a larrikin. I got the sticker printed a week later. Ordered 1,000. I was a bit overzealous, I think, getting 1,000, but they went in the first few weeks. I set up a Facebook page. I look back at, you know, Facebook now is nice. It gives you memories. What is it? Where you look back on you. And I look at the posts that I did for Stay Chatty early days, and it was pretty dire. It was sort of me writing about how shit my life was, missing my little brother. You know, I'd drive home from cricket training or footy training, and you know, I'd drive past the cemetery, I'd drive past a young boy that looked like him, and I'd write about how I'd break down. Again, making myself vulnerable in a bid to create change, but getting people to slap a sticker on, think of Ty in a happy place, but more importantly, cuddle your friends, cuddle your family, and make yourself vulnerable and speak up. Yeah, it kind of blew up. The Facebook page now is about 28,000 likes, but in the first few weeks, just everyone liked it. You know, Tig was a popular guy. I was fortunate enough to have connections in footy clubs and sporting clubs across the south. Jackie Rewilder, a close friend, He was on the Footy Show and he put the logo up and, you know, doesn't get much better than that.
Wow.
And he'd tell people what we were doing and mentioned how he'd come to Ty's funeral and, you know, how heartbreaking it was. And, yeah, it just sort of took off. I remember I stood up in front of my footy club when they asked me about it and I told them about Stay Chatty. And I jumped in the car after that and thought, geez, that was shit house, that bit of public speaking. But a lot of people wrote to me and said, Mitch, you know, you standing up there and talking about your pain really resonated with us, and we thank you for that. And, you know, I did a bit of drama in grade 10, but I then started to put together a bit of a presentation and think, you know what, this is probably something I could do. You know, maybe I could be a bit of an advocate and start sharing my story and telling people about it. And, yeah, put myself out there, started getting called out to workplaces in between my glazing work. My glazing boss got sick of it in the end because I was probably having a day a week for a couple of months going out and doing this sort of work, and it just sort of overcome my life. I'd, you know, sell stickers, wristbands, come up with posts, quotes. We set it up as a registered charity with the help of some great friends. And then, yeah, in 2014, the greatest thing ever happened, Relationships Australia Tasmania. Their CEO, who just moved on, Matt Rao, I'll never forget, he called and he said, Mitch, we've noticed what you're doing in the community. Come and have an interview. And I went in and sat with them. And, yeah, after a couple of chats, they offered me employment with them and said, we love what you're doing. We would love to partner with you and help you grow Stay Chatty. And, yeah, fast forward 7 years, Stay Chatty is a bit of a beast now here in Tasmania. We've, you know, $1 million worth of state funding, 7 employees, youth reference groups, sports program. Yeah, it's a really amazing thing that we've turned it into. I never, you know, I know that I was the one that started it and I know that I was passionate about it, but, you know, so many people believed in it and so many people wanted to, you know, so many people had been touched by suicide and I had no idea. Mm-hmm. And so therefore they got on board and helped. And yeah, now it's a really big movement that we're creeping into interstate, and it's really exciting still even 7 years on, which is something I'm really, really proud of.
You travel extensively around Tassie, and I think you do a little bit around the rest of Australia as well, speaking at schools and footy clubs and sport, all different kinds of sporting clubs.
Yep.
What did you learn in those early stages, and I guess what do you hear now about how young people are feeling?
Yeah, I think that the stigma is definitely there. I mean, our school program, I was really keen to work with kids to start off with. I think that's one of the things I said to Relationships Australia when I sat down with them, was that, you know, I want to work with people that were around all my brother's age, because I truly believe that I miss those signs and I want to tell these young people what those signs are. When we started doing work in schools, you know, something that I'm really proud of at Stay Chatty and RA is that we evaluate everything now. All our programs, presentations, we send surveys, we capture all the feedback that people want to give us. And young people were writing in there thanking us, you know, for the work that we're doing, but they were saying that, A, they didn't know where the help was, and B, a lot of them were afraid to do so. But now after our program, they feel more comfortable and they know the services that are available. And I think it's so important just to, A, let kids know that it's okay to talk, and B, where the help is available, because we might think that they know 13, 11, 14 Lifeline, but I think they need to know as many as they can, because what happens if a young person picks up the phone and calls Lifeline and they get someone on the phone that is not a good connection for them? I'm sure a lot of them will give up hope and think that that's it. But giving them the amount of resource, like tons of resources out there and other numbers that they can call, I often say to kids, it might take you 4 or 5 times to find someone on the other edge of the phone that is a good connection for you, but keep trying, because you will find someone that you connect with. You will get that solid connection to be able to open up and talk about how you're feeling. And one thing I really ramble on about with kids is kindness. I think I really believe that a kinder world will create a huge amount of change in terms of mental health and how we see each other. You know, I said at the start, we're all doing life together, and we need to remember that everyone, you know, this is a jam-packed world, and if you get that opportunity to do something nice or say something nice, do it, because it creates a huge amount of change. You know, I love the end of our school program. As I said, I don't get to do it as much anymore because we've got other amazing people that are doing it, but I stand up and I say, guys, there are people in this room that are different to you, but guess what? Who gives a shit? That person next to you has a heart, they have a family, they have feelings. So next time you want to open your mouth or write something about them, think about how it would make you feel. And I genuinely, truly love that moment, because I really feel it strikes me. I see their eyes light up. I see them thinking about moments where they've been bullied. I see moments in their eyes where they've bullied someone. And I really believe that change occurs in that moment. And we've had, you know, that's why I think schools get us back, and it's something, again, I'll say the word pride and proud. You know, schools get us back because that's what they need to hear. They need to hear that how they speak to each other, how they say things to each other is damaging. And, you know, people can kill themselves and take their own life because of one word that you say, and that's something really difficult to live with. So kindness, I think, is something if we can instill into young people, it will go a bloody long way moving forward, absolutely.
What kind of tangible impact has your work had? Have you had people that have come to you and said, after hearing your message, you know, it's prevented them from doing something, or it's helped them reach out for help? What are there, you know, what kind of tangible impact has it had? And are there any, you know, is there a handful of stories you can tell us that really stand out in your mind and make everything feel like, you know, everything you're doing has so much purpose?
Yeah, I think those moments for me are why I still do it. I've certainly over the years, you know, I've done over 600 presentations now, and
wow.
I think standing up there talking, my opening line is, I don't really want to be here doing this today, but I do it because no one ever did it for me. And sharing my story is tough, you know, I well up, I'm basically reliving the worst thing that, yeah, you know, ever happened to me in my life, and it's difficult to do, but for me, there's been a lot of moments where I've come home and it's been emotionally draining because of what I'm doing, or I just think, you know, maybe I need a change. But the things that, the reason I suppose I keep doing it is those stories of feedback and messages. I've got a positive feedback folder in my email. I'm trying to think of one off the top, and of course I can't think of any, but they for me are the reason that people have said to us, people have gone as far as to say that because of Stay Chatty going to their school or their workplace, they are still alive today. Wow. Because of our work and our message. And there's one young girl who follow each other on social media, and I spoke somewhere once, and she came up at the end and had a conversation with me about how she'd lost her own brother, and we've formed like a bit of a friendship since then, and now she does fundraising for us, and, you know, she does Stay Chatty's got an initiative called Stories Worth Sharing, where we invite people to share their own story of mental health, depression, anxiety. We put it on our socials. She's done that. You know, she's turned everything around and has this new sense of that she can grasp life with two fresh hands because of Stay Chatty. And, you know, that for me is incredible to think that, you know, what I went through and being able to turn that into this positive for people to see us as a leader in this, and reminding them that they too can create change, blows me away. I mean, people hit me up for a coffee to say, how did you start your not-for-profit, you know, such a successful organisation? And I sit back and I think, I can't believe people are asking me that. You know, I'm a tradie who put windows in, and but that was running silicon beads up showers. But because I suppose I just say to people, I was passionate, I believed in it, I knew it needed to happen. You know, grab things with both hands and truly believe that you can create change. And yeah, so yeah, long-winded answer that, but the reality is that, yeah, that's what keeps us going. The people have opened up and been honest enough to say, thank you, you've saved my life, or you've saved someone I know. And, you know, there's nothing more powerful than that. I truly love that. It's a really special thing.
Does it feel like when you, you know, after everything you've just said then, does this feel like a life purpose to you?
Yes. Yeah. I certainly found my purpose through this. Yeah, I'd give anything to have Ty back. I'd give absolutely anything to be able to, you know, wrap my arms around him and tell him that things are going to be okay. But it definitely did allow me to find my purpose. You know, I was quite lost when I look back. You know, yeah, I wasn't off the rails, and I had good friendship base and all those amazing things and healthy, et cetera. But I was putting windows in and I wasn't content. You know, I'd still kick my boots off and think I don't really want to go back and do that tomorrow. So I'm very fortunate too that no, I absolutely love my job. I love what I do. I spring out of bed every day knowing what it is that I can do to create some positive change within communities, our state, or even the country. And so that's a thrill for me. And I'm very, very lucky and will forever be grateful and be indebted to those that believed in me and gave me that opportunity to do it. So, yeah, I mean, I don't say to people, oh, if you hate your job, throw it in and get out there and do something different. Yeah, if you can, absolutely. But I certainly, am very, very fortunate to have that opportunity, absolutely.
How do you hope to see Speak Up, Stay Chatty grow from now?
Yeah, I always said I wanted it to be a national organisation. I mean, as I said, we've got funding for our schools program. Julia and Kat run that down here. We've got a funding for our sports program, youth reference group. There's a lot of things happening in Tassie. What I've learned is the education departments all sort of have their own mental health programs in schools, and there's a lot of work to crack that. You know, like, we've got a fantastic relationship with our government and our education department in Tasmania, and our schools program is going really, really well. To get it interstate is, you know, is incredibly difficult, because there's a lot of other great organisations like ours doing it. I believe our sports program is really tangible, and we're having some really exciting conversations with a lot of people at the moment about how that could be adapted, because I've spoken at some forums around the country for sport, and there is a real need for things such as our program, you know, getting groups in and talking about how off-the-field performance will absolutely better your on-field performance. So there's a real market for it out there. But then there's my speaking. Yeah, you know, I'm starting to do a lot more speaking interstate, which is really exciting. They obviously got canned this year. This was probably going to be my biggest year for my speaking. They've all been postponed, fortunately, so that means later on or next year I'll still get that opportunity to do so. But I think that's a really good way to spread our message around the country. And I'm, you know, I don't just stand up there on behalf of my family when I do talks interstate. I'd honestly stand up there as a real proud Tasmanian, telling people that, you know, we've got the second highest rate of suicide in Australia. I'm just a young bloke that lost someone who is really passionate about this, and you can create some change in your household or your workplace. So I believe that's how, you know, people send me photos seeing a sticker in Melbourne and Sydney and Perth, and, you know, it melts my heart. I probably have a little cry when they come through, because I will never forget why that sticker was created. But there's that real sense of pride that Stage 8 is growing. But I also don't want to do it for the rest of my life. You know, I'm not silly. I know that I'll burn out in doing this work. I'm fully passionate for it right now. But, you know, I've been off 6 weeks now on paternity and sick leave with a bad knee, and the wheels are turning. The people that work for us are passionate. They're engaging. They love what they do. And I know that this will be a legacy that I leave behind. I hope it sticks around forever, and it'll be what Mitch McPherson created. But what's in store for me next, I'm not really sure just yet.
What does grief look like to you, and what does it look like now?
I still feel that moment, you know, that night when Mum rang, and it was like a movie scene. You know, I never forget my girlfriend, who's Sahar, my wife now, you know, dropping me at the end of Mum's cul-de-sac, and seeing the ambulance and police up the end of their house right at the end, and, you know, running and falling over in the middle of the street, and a random neighbour holding me while I'm on my knee screaming. You know, like, that's stuff you see in movies. And I think I'd never – that's, you know, you talk about PTSD, and no disrespect to people that have gone to war and all that stuff, but I, you know, if I hear, especially now with Maya, you know, if I hear Sahar yell out, I panic and I run, and I'm really on edge. And I'm, you know, fortunate that at Relationships Australia, there's some, like, support you get with counsellors that work at RA, where it's not counselling, but it's called supervision, where once a fortnight you can sit down with this supervisor and just open up and get some support for your work and your life. And I utilise that as best I can, because one of the things I do struggle with is fear that something like that will happen to me again. Yeah, if my wife yells or someone, I hear a loud noise, I really do fall into that moment, and it takes me back to that moment back then. And I lost my nan and pop within a year and a half after losing Ty. I was incredibly close to them, but I feel I was still numb from Ty when I lost them. And since, I haven't lost anyone, but I now live with a real fear that I will. And I know I will lose people. But grief for me comes with a real sense of fear. I worry of how I will deal with it. And so I do as much work as I can behind the scenes to brace myself for that, because I worry, you know, I'm not fragile or I'm not unstable, but I do worry how I will deal with that. You know, life's good to be able to tell my story right now how it is, but if a key person in that story was removed from it, I feel I'll really struggle to get it out. So, yeah, it's amazing how those things happen, that, you know, you never think that you'll go, like I said, like a movie, you never think you'll go through something like that, and it is crazy how it changes you. I sort of live on the edge a little bit with that. Yeah, it's really strange.
What you've spoken previously on other things and in your speech that you make about the five ways we can create change. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, well, I haven't done a presentation for a couple of months now, so I'll have to try and remember what they are. get help when you need it is a really big one. We just sort of spoke about that, and I think that goes without saying. It's okay to not be okay is a big one to finish on. Listening saves lives. Listening is a big one. What I've learned in all my training, again, I go back to the training and resourcing I've done over the years for mental health. A lot of us don't ask someone how they're travelling because they think we're going to have to fix that person's problems. I know I was like that back in the day. If I saw a mate or a family member that was off their game, I think, you know, if I ask them how they're travelling, I'm then going to have to be the one that fixes their problem, and how will I ever sleep if I don't? You've got to forget that. You've got to not be that. You just ask the question, let them get it off their chest, and then point them in the direction of a service or a way in which they can get that support. So listening saves lives is imperative and really important for us to know that you don't have to be that expert. Leave it to the experts to have that conversation with them to get through it. I'm trying to picture my screen. It's okay to not be okay. Listen, saves lives, get help when you need it. And there's one more that I cannot... Oh, kindness. Kindness is the other one as well. Kindness, yeah. I think I've already gone on about that enough as to how we can create change. I often say about kindness, what I do now, our office is in Salamanca, and for those listening outside of Tasmania, Salamanca is the hot spot of, you would know, of Hobart. Mm-hmm. And our office is there, and I walk down and I spend shitloads of money on coffee and food. And every time I walk down the street, I always... acknowledge people that walk past me. I will always pride myself on being that person that gives a little nod or says g'day or says hello to those going past me. I often joke that I don't really do it with my wife anymore. She thinks I'm a bit unusual. She tells me to stop saying hello to people when I walk around the street. But for me, that is my little act of kindness and my little reminder to people to know, you know what? People out there do care, and there is people out there that will listen and will understand me. And for me, that's my reminder to them. And it also... releases some endorphins, if you like, for me, and makes me feel good, like I'm playing my part. So kindness is another one as well.
How has this experience with your brother Ty altered the way you'll parent your new daughter?
Yeah, well, given she's nearly 6 weeks old and I've been stuck in isolation, I've been thinking about that a lot. I think an open door system will be so important. I've met so many parents that have messaged me or email us through Stay Chatty or whatever avenues it is and say, oh, I can't get through to my child. You know, they won't come and talk to me. They think that I'm going to tell someone, or they don't see me as that person. And I know things can change, and there's factors throughout life that your child will be as close to you as ever, and then they'll get to 10 years of age and then that breaks away. I think one thing I'll do as much as I absolutely possibly can is, for as long as I can, remind them that my door is always open and that I will be there for a conversation, and I will move heaven and earth to help her get through that time, and that absolutely nothing that she comes to me with will be unusual or strange. I've been around the block, and you have. I'm sure every parent has had moments in their life where they've played up, they've done things different or wrong and said stuff they wish they hadn't have. We've all been there. We've been in that situation. So I think in terms of parenting, I'll encourage her to be kind. I'll encourage her to be herself, but I'll encourage her to come to me whenever she has anything wrong, because I will be there for her as much as I can. And as I said, there's be people out there listening saying, oh, I did all that. I know that can always go pear-shaped, but as long as I know that I did as much as I could to remind her that Dad would be there for her, that's going to be really special for me, and I hope that she utilises it moving forward.
And do you think Ty would be proud of you?
Yeah, I was waiting for this question. I thought, here we go. This is where I'll probably lose my shit a little bit at the end. Yeah, definitely. Yep. I remember when I held her in the hospital and, you know, straight away thought of him. And I said to my wife only yesterday that, you know, we don't go to the cemetery as much anymore. It's only 5 minutes down the road, you know, and I call him there on birthdays and stuff like that. And I think it'll be important over the next few weeks. I really want to take her there. And sorry, getting upset.
you don't have to apologise at all.
big sook on the podcast. But yeah, I think there's always moments in life where, you know, won awards and things like that for what I'm doing, and you'd give them all back to have him back. But I know he'd be looking down and he'd be really proud, yeah.
Yeah. It's made me emotional too. Oh, now, I finished. No, please don't apologise. I Ugh, no, not at all.
That's okay.
Now, I finish all my podcasts in the same way, and that's what would Mitch now tell the Mitch in his darkest moments when the world felt like a very scary place? What would you tell that Mitch now?
If I was in a dark place to get out, what would I do? I get out. One thing I've found so therapeutic these days is to go for a walk, and that sucked over the last 6 weeks. I had some complications with knee surgery, and I can't get out and do that at the moment. And I think getting outside of four walls is just one of the most incredible things that we just take for granted. I, this past 6 weeks, being in isolation and not being able to walk physically has mentally drained me so much. And I think that in my hours, of losing tie or flat moments I've had throughout my life, when I've sat in the four walls of a bedroom or a lounge room, it has taken so much longer to get better. And I just think if you can appreciate the fresh air and getting out and looking up at the sky and realising that tomorrow is a new day, that is such a powerful thing that I think we all need to start appreciating a lot more. And I hope that given isolation and coronavirus, that it's something that we do think about a little bit more and take for granted, being able to get out of our house. But there's all that stuff about connection and pick up the phone, and that's important, and ring a service. But I think just get outside, look up at the sky and think, today's a shitty day and I'm in the middle of a bit of a shitty moment, but tomorrow is going to be a new day. And by getting this fresh air in, it might give you that little bit of strength to make that call or to open up to someone to tell them how you're feeling. So get outside of your four walls, look up, look around and have some positive vibes, and it'll hopefully make you feel a little bit better.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mitch. You've been so wonderful. This conversation's been so enlightening for me, and I've got so much out of it. And the way you've spoken so honestly and candidly has been really beautiful and vulnerable. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. As I said, after not speaking about it for 6 weeks, I didn't realise that I would get so emotionally attached to it. But it's good for me to let out a few emotions as well. And I really appreciate it. And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. It's such an important message to share, so I can't wait to get it out there. Thank you again. And best of luck with fatherhood. It's so exciting. Yeah. What a magical time.
Thank you so much. It's amazing. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you got so much out of this epic chat with the brilliant Mitch McPherson, especially if you were the mum of young boys like I am. I'll pop links to Speak Up, Stay Chatty's website and social media in the show notes, as well as Mitch's Instagram. As always, you can connect with me at Elizabeth O'Neill. Again, if this chat has brought up any discomfort, 24-hour crisis support is available through Lifeline on 13 11 14. Have a brilliant rest of the week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.